Thank you. So let me start by remarking that I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but if some Martian would come down to Earth and see what statistical people working in statistical mechanics are doing, it would be astonishing to see that so much is equilibrium compared to how rarely equilibrium is the relevant thing. And this is especially evident when you think of glasses, which by nature are out of equilibrium, but it's also true in many circumstances. Maybe the quantum people are a bit more innocent because they have some sort of time in there, inevitably. Although this is imaginary time usually, or almost always, and so it's less good. So, and the reason why, mainly apart from inertia, is inertia, I mean, historical inertia, is that it is true that once you're out of equilibrium, you lose a lot of nice and universal results. And so it might feel that just about anything can happen out of equilibrium. For example, you can have phase transitions in one dimension, which you cannot in equilibrium. You can have phase transition induced by shear or by current or by anything. Just about anything and its contrary can happen. And so people feel that the world of out of equilibrium is too vast and you have too very few ideas of what to do. In this sense, I think glasses are a bit better than, and granular matter, dense granular matter too, are in a slightly better shape, because as I'm going to try to show you, of all the possible ways of being out of equilibrium, which are many, glasses have a very, very specific way of doing it, and it might be that one can have rules or guiding principles that normally one doesn't have, for example, in turbulence or in that kind of most general out of equilibrium situations. These ideas, this mixture, there's some of these ideas are from even before the war, the Second World War. They were phenomenologically stated in a phenomenological way. They are closely related to ideas much later that Edwards, also phenomenological ideas of Edwards in the context of granular matter. The line which I will present here is a line that was, I think, very much started by Annette and Sompolinski a lot of years ago. It's a more theoretical line, and it's been a recent surprise that it finally rejoins these old ideas, which we now think we understand beyond a phenomenological level. So let me start by saying what a glass is. First of all, sometimes people ask, how do you define a glass? In fact,
back one question before you begin that.
Please.
It's a very general question. Is there a way of classifying how things are out of equilibrium? How do you quantify
that? It would be nice to have guiding principles. So you say type A out of equilibrium, type B, and so on and so forth. As far as I know, there's nothing like that. You can, of course, have situations where you can do things. For example, you could have a system that is out of equilibrium but critical. And then you can resort to things from renormalization group, for example. But that's for one point in phase space.
There's no general nothing.
In fact, what I can say about the kind of system I will talk about, glasses in particular, is that the level of when you're driving a system, or when a system is out of equilibrium, there's entropy being produced. Glasses are going to be systems that where entropy is produced, but at a very, very slow rate. Obviously, not much is happening in a window glass, but they are out of equilibrium, and very much out of equilibrium, although the level of entropy production is very slow, very low. But that's not enough to completely classify, let's say, a system. So sometimes people ask, how do you define a glass? In fact, I think that the best thing to say is that a glass is like a syndrome. It's you have a few things that you might have that glasses tend to have, they have in common with the objects we traditionally call glass, and then your definition doesn't have to be a strict one. After all, The objects of physics are not like the objects of mathematics. So I'm going to just start with an example and start with a phenomenology. When you see this phenomenology all taken together, or at least some aspects, then you say you have a glass. So what kind of system makes a glass? Well, let us consider a system of particles, which we shall assume that they are polydispersed. We don't want them to be all exactly the same, because then it's easy for them to crystallize, which is nice, but it's not what we want. So for example, two sizes will do, or even more polydispersity. We will assume that there's always. And they might be hard, but I'm going to assume that they have some sort of repulsive potential, at least at big distances. So this, at an appropriate regime of low energy, will create a glass. Now, if in addition you accept this could be a system of elastic particles, so just like, I don't know, any particle system. Now, if in addition you accept that there might possibly be friction, frictional forces, as if this would be in suspension in a water, then you can include colloids, which are exactly this kind of object, or wet foams. Wet foams are foams that have a lot of water, and our particles are going to be the air bubbles inside. So wet foams would also fall into this category. And if, in addition, you accept in your definition that you have static friction, so there's a threshold after which things move, then even granular matter would fall into the, dense granular matter would fall into this class. So I'm mentioning this because all these subjects go together. A different kind of system with slow dynamics, to which I will make allusion, not because glasses, this kind of glasses necessarily are like that, but it's always useful to have in mind, is the phase separation or domain growth. So imagine you have a liquid, vinegar and oil, so you have your oil in vinegar. And slowly, the oil droplets coalesce. And so the system has droplets which have a typical size, which on average grows with time. This, of course, in this glass, this has slow dynamics, and I'm going to come back to this. But in this glass, you will have immediately phase separation, as I mentioned, and, for example, domain growth, ferromagnetic domain growth, with up and down domains in a ferromagnet, for example, and also dry foams. Dry foams are, for example, in two dimensions, when you have just very thin soap films separating regions of air. So a dry foam can be viewed, at least in 2D, as domains. And it's much more in this class than a wet foam, which is much more like a particle system. But I'm going to come back always to this example, because this is a class of out-of-equilibrium system. Out-of-equilibrium is because these things keep on growing. And many of the things that happen in an ordinary glass, one can picture them in a certain sense in this context. So it is useful to keep in mind.
Okay,
yes, please.
Is any out-of-equilibrium system behaving as a glass, or there is difference between this type of phase separation and...
Well, one of the consequences or the end products of what I'm going to tell is that you can see already a difference that between how these behaves and these behave, although they have a lot of things in common, because there is also a related question. Is every out-of-equilibrium, let's say, aging system, some form of domain growth, even if I don't know what the domains are made of? Are there any lengths growing this way? And this, the answer to this, we don't know. But I will say what are the things that, in a way, characterize this kind of dynamics. But many things they do have in common with glasses, and many things are easy to picture. I'm going to come back and back again all the time. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, the question is, what is the difference between this system from any general...
Out of equilibrium system.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. First of all, compared to turbulence, for example, to developed turbulence, so you're putting always energy inside and you have all these eddies that are giving, this system is more like decaying turbulence in the sense that you have structures that get bigger and bigger, and so there is a progressive sense in which the system is getting older and older. In this case, the bubbles are getting bigger and bigger. So in this sense, this is different from a generic out of equilibrium system, which could be driven. But you could drive this one too.
But Sure.
And on top of it, about entropy production I was mentioning, here almost everything is in local equilibrium except for the walls. So everything that is non-equilibrium is responsibility of the walls, of the fact that there being walls there. So relatively speaking, what is out of equilibrium here is something that is relatively sparse and becomes sparser as time passes. However, these walls, which are not very dense, will do something at any finite time. So in this sense, it is like glasses in the sense that there are not many things. Whatever is out of equilibrium is, in a sense, something that is not very dense and having a lot of energy. So, but I'll come back again as this I will use mostly as an example, so just to clear mind. By the way, when I said dry foams are like in this class, in fact, a dry foam, you can see it as a phase coarsening, not of a ferromagnet, but of a Potts model with many components. So even formally, it is in this class. Okay, so the things we know, from where do they come? I'm going to give you a model which we can solve analytically. It's not the best, it's not the first that was studied, but I think that it's the one that is better for making a few points. So we want to model this particle system and see what it does dynamically, because we know that it will not be in equilibrium, so we're forced to do dynamics. So a model that plays the role of a Curie vise for this kind of situation is, imagine you have a sphere of n dimensions, n is going to be very large, and on this sphere you have particles, which are spherical sectors, m of them, order n, so there are also many particles, and with some sort of repulsive interaction. Could be anything, it could be even hard spheres. So there are many of these objects which are interacting with one another, and in a space of many dimensions. The many dimension comes in to make it solvable, to make it mean fieldy. So notice that there is no explicit form of disorder like you would have in a spin glass. This is why I chose this example. It is a bit artificial because a particle tends to interact with many others because of high dimensionality, and this makes it solvable. It's not so easy to solve the dynamics or the statics of this, but you can do it in the large n limit. So this is a caricature, of course, and it will have a lot of problems associated with it being mean field, but you will see that you get a lot of things which you wouldn't have guessed otherwise. So this is at least what you can say in favor. It turns out that it's not really necessary in this case, because in many dimensions, in order to crystallize, I mean, it's not easy for the system to do it. But if you would want to completely avoid crystallization, then you would make it polydispersed. But it's not particularly necessary here. There's a lot of number theory also, because depending on the dimensionality, all sorts of interesting things happen. Okay, so if I call the coordinates of these particles xa, which is a vector fixed norm in n-dimensional space, the dynamics is going to be some Langevin dynamics. I could have added inertia. It's not particularly helpful, but you could do it. In a quantum system, which you can do a version of, I'm going to mention this, it would be almost inevitable to have inertia. So this is a Langevin equation. And then, well, the trick is you write this, and then you're supposed to be able to solve that. I'm not going to say how you do that, but what I just want to say is that you can solve it, and a number of things emerge, and then the question is, as usual, the first step is to have a mean field theory, and then to see how many of the features are pathological. In fact, the examples of results that I'm going to show are going to be on simulations or more realistic systems. Okay, so what does a glass do? A glass like this one do? Here? Why? Sorry?
Why is first derivative?
Well, this is the force, simply. This is the force. Why this first derivative? Because I neglected the inertia.
But
this is just...
This should probably be a damping constant.
This is the damping. So, okay. So, what let me describe this syndrome of glassiness. So, let me consider a system of particles, and I make them soft so I can use energy, because I like it, but I could have made them hard and use volume. And, well, at high temperatures, what I will have is a liquid. So, I'm going down in energy. I have a liquid, which is getting progressively more viscous. And I'm always in equilibrium. Whatever I do for the moment is in equilibrium, so I tune the temperature very slowly. At a certain point, you reach a temperature at which the system might want to crystallize. And to do so, it would do this very rapidly, if you can nucleate. And then it would be a crystal. So this is the equilibrium phase. The question as to whether always there is a possible crystal for a system, I don't think the answer is known. So, but it's an irrelevant question in this context. Yes.
When you say energy, you mean potential energy?
Yes. Potential energy. Or it could be, well, if you add inertia, it could also be kinetic, but the total energy.
But the temperature is directly
related
to kinetic energy, right?
I mean, make it the total energy, kinetic. So, I mean, if your system is a system of elastic particles, make it the total energy. No, yes, sure. If it's a Langevin system, it will be the strength of the noise. But this is an experimental system, so I'm not talking about the model itself. This is just, it could be particles, but if it's a colloid, then there is no kinetic energy because this is in water. So at this point, thermodynamics tells you that you would want to create a crystal, and then not much happens with the crystal. But you might kinetically avoid this and continue with... Oops. Lowering the temperature, and you will have a liquid which is super cooled because it's really not in equilibrium, because the equilibrium phase here would be the crystal. So let me first say that this liquid here is, formally speaking, not in equilibrium in the sense that the equilibrium phase is a crystal, but for all practical purposes it is still in equilibrium. And just to give you an example, if you have a mixture of hot oxygen and hydrogen in a bottle and you don't make a spark, then, of course, the equilibrium phase is water and not oxygen and hydrogen. But for all practical purposes, and it takes very long to spontaneously nucleate water, and this oxygen, this mixture, is going to be an ideal, pretty much ideal gas of oxygen. That kind of non-equilibrium, the other classical example is diamond. Diamond is unstable, in fact. It nucleates graphite. But it doesn't happen very quickly. And so diamond is, for all practical purposes, in equilibrium. This is the kind of system I have here. So forget about the fact, it's only a technicality, the fact that it's out of equilibrium. For all practical purposes, you can still consider it in equilibrium. And forget about the crystal. Let's ignore it. Yes?
You were talking about equilibrium and non-equilibrium as the two distinct states. But I'm sure you can come up with places where you're right in the middle, where you don't. So, I mean, it's really not a matter of talking about is it or is it not in equilibrium. It's not never in equilibrium. It's just a question of how.
Okay.
What the time scale.
Okay. Okay. So, yes, but let me say, if you use the equilibrium measure to predict things, and you know that here, going beyond the melting point, this is very different from a crystal, which is the equilibrium. So you're wide off the mark. However, and it will be clear to you in a second what will I mean exactly by equilibrium. But you will, basically, one of the things that has to happen is that if you stick a thermometer in your system, you measure the temperature of the system. You will hear. And in this sense, this is not a dramatic out of equilibrium. It's just metastable. So forget about the crystal from now onwards. Let's suppose that your experimental procedure managed to avoid it. So, okay, this is called a supercooled liquid. So let's say I go from a temperature A to another point B, then I lower still my temperature to another point C. So let me suppose that in order to measure the properties of this system, let me take a test tube, an inverted test tube, with the liquid inside. So this is the liquid inside. This will have a little piston, and which doesn't let the liquid go away. And I am going to measure, this is one possibility, the spontaneous changes in volume, the noise of volume, if you will. And I am also going to measure the response of the system to a push of this piston. So I do two things. I look at the spontaneous motion of the piston or the response to... So one of the things I can see, I can try to look at, is the correlation function, two-time correlation function, which would be the noise of this vibrations, the average means, for example, repeating the experiment many times and then taking average over all the realizations. This is one possibility. The other possibility is a response function, which consists of the following. I kick this system with a certain force during a time that goes from TW to T, and I look at what that effect will have on delta x at time t. This is a response function. Okay? So these are the two measurements I'm going to do with this little piston. This is just one quantity I could measure.
Your correlation function, t prime, is...
Oh, sorry, it's tw. It's the smallest time. I use tw, which stands for waiting time. I'm going to come to this now. So what happens as I go down in temperature? So when I'm in point, what happens is the following. If I look at the correlation, and this is T minus TW, in point A, what I notice is that I have that the correlation, there is a decorrelation, which is relatively fast, plus it gets to a plateau and then plus a decorrelation, which is relatively slower. So what is happening is that when I look at the vibrations of this piston, I see relatively rapid vibrations superposed to relatively slow motion of this piston. In a second, I'm going to tell you why this happens, but for the moment, this is what you observe. Next, in point B, what I see is I'm lower in temperature. I see something very similar. The rapid vibrations have not changed very much, but the slow ones have become much slower. So this in A would look like something like this. In B, it would look like something like this. The rapid thing hasn't changed much, the slow things became slower. And as I go down to C, I see that, again, this becomes even slower. The rapid motion hasn't changed much, but the slow motion has become much slower. Now, I can also do the measurement with a response. So what do? I push the system from TW to T and see what the system does. So if I do it in A, what happens, so I do it when the liquid was relatively hotter, is that the system responds relatively fast, and then very slowly it creeps to a new position. Here, logarithm of T minus TW. I just put log to highlight the fact that this is really much slower than that. Yes, sorry.
Probably you want to argue that the correlation depends on two times later.
Later.
So, how do you choose them now?
It will come in a second. It'll come, because for the moment, this is entirely arbitrary. Because I'm in equilibrium, so any TW will do. So now if I push and I do the same experiment at point B, the system responds rather rapidly. Just this would be the kind of response you would have for sound waves. It's a rapid elastic response. And then what you find is that this, then there is this creep which has become much slower. And if I do it in C, again, the same happens. And it's, again, the creep is become much slower. So if this, what? The, okay, so let me remark here very quickly that it is no surprise that these two things are related, because we are in equilibrium and correlation and responses are related by the fluctuation dissipation theorem, of which much more in a while. But if I plot parametrically the response versus the correlation, I am told that this has to give a straight line with gradient minus 1 over t. This is just equilibrium statistical mechanics. So no surprise that these two things are related. Okay, so for the moment what I want to say is that this defines a time scale, t alpha. It's traditionally called the alpha relaxation time scale, which is, say, what it takes for the slow part of the correlation to do half its relaxation. And having defined this correlation time alpha, I can, together with this plot, I can add another plot, which, and now I really need a logarithm, because this is going to be very dramatic. And what I see is that this correlation time alpha, it's A, B, and I got here C. And this is going to explode in a second. It will really go up very sharply. Yes?
So what are the two times?
What are the two times?
Physically, what is that?
Okay, physically, I'm going to give you a picture in a second, and then you want the order of magnitude or the physical basis? In a second. So, okay, so now I'm going to give you the physical basis. What is happening is that, well, the piston is here, but why is the piston reacting in this way? And any other correlation will do the same. Is that what happens is that the particles tend to move, to vibrate, like in a cage made of the other particles, just like in a crystal where you have vibrations around your free position, plus a much slower motion, because it's, remember, it's a liquid and not a crystal, which allows it to just move outside, let's say, the instantaneous cage. So think of a person in a crowd which can more or less move around its empty space around it. And then very slowly it could also drift, between people. So this motion is traditionally called the cage motion. Cage is something that changes with time, rearranges with time, and it's very much like what happens in a crystal. You move inside your, around your equilibrium position. And this is usually called the structural motion away from the cage. So when you're doing this experiment and you're compressing your liquid, the cages react almost instantaneously, and they compress. And then this creep motion is due to these very slow, much slower rearrangements, much more difficult rearrangements. So physically, what
we're studying computation with the Rama about 20 or 30 years.
At least.
They're very dramatic.
Yeah, yeah. And let me say that viscosity, which is something that is growing concomitantly with T alpha, is the responsibility of these structural motions. You would expect that because you're shearing, so the rearrangements that allow you to move the liquid are the slow relaxations. And these, what is happening is something rather surprising. It's that the fast motion is not changing very much, because inside the cage you move relatively freely, so changing the temperature by a little bit doesn't change life a lot. But the structural motion, where you have to move through the crowd, is getting progressively much, 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 much harder as temperature.
The time of the structural motion. How so the structure.
This is going to change when I change temperature by 14 orders of magnitude, at least.
But you define it as a move from one particle place to another place.
Basically, a distance further than the interparticle distance.
Okay.
It could be even a little bit smaller, because then you make rearrangements.
It feels
Is it a matter of local equilibrium versus...
It will come, but yes, to a certain extent, this is very much like you would have in an equilibrated system, and this is something, for the moment, in equilibrium, because I haven't fallen out of equilibrium, but this is something that will immediately feel the out-of-equilibrium nature when it comes in 2 minutes. 2 minutes is now, because when, imagine your time scale gets to 1 second and you're cooling your system, now I have a problem, because we are saying that this structural motion takes this kind of time. But now if I'm changing the temperature faster than that kind of time, it's clear that I will not be able to equilibrate the system, because the system will lose step with the changes I am making. So even though this curve, if I did it very slowly, would come to the next point D, which I'm going to exaggerate a lot, what happens, in fact, is because I'm doing my experiment at a certain speed, somehow I fell out of pace. And this is the moment where what I will see in the experiment is that the energy, instead of going down as it should in equilibrium to a point, say, here, D, something strange happens and the system blocks. Why? Because in order to really lower its energy, it would have had to be able to do a lot of rearrangements, which time does not permit now. Of course, had I done the thing slower, then this would have happened later on. But so now, first question, is there a true divergence in this time so that inevitably, at any speed I go, I will always fall out of equilibrium? Or is this just going to level off, and in practice I cannot follow in equilibrium, but in theory I could? This question is as old as glasses, and to a certain extent it is a moot point, because in fact this kind of growth is 14 orders of magnitude. So between, say, 18 orders of magnitude and infinity, there is not much difference for us. So whether this time really would diverge so that inevitably whatever you do, you fall out of equilibrium, and or whether in fact this is something like this, only that it becomes so slow that you cannot, well, you will find systems that would do both perhaps, but it doesn't change your life. It could. Yeah, it could. It could go on, or it could diverge in zero. There are cases, I mean, window glasses, nobody believes that this diverges at a finite temperature. They believe that it diverges at zero, if at all. But what I want to stress is that personally, I don't take the point of view that that is a particularly relevant question. It would be nice to know the answer, but we are not going to know it, so in any case.
That it's probably experimentally very hard to answer, but from a theoretical point of view, I think it's important, because if it diverges, that would mean that there is an equilibrium phase to it.
Sure. But what I'm going to try to argue is that even when there is not, the phenomenology is the same as when there is. So, as far as out of equilibrium. So, to the extent that I am out of equilibrium here, the fact that this point is in infinity or is further up will not change the phenomenology. This is what I'm going to argue. So I can do and say a lot of things before knowing the answer to the question as to whether there is or not an equilibrium phase transition, which is good, because I'm not going to know that in this lifetime, so it allows me to do some things, a few things. Yes?
Maybe I'm jumping too far, but if you will consider some high order correlation functions, not simple, some high order, they
when
in the same way, what the points where they are diverging obviously will be dependent on which correlation.
If there is a divergence, they should, I guess, diverge in the same place if there is a transition. But then they will grow in some sort of manner, and they will, all of them will grow when the times they involve are separated, but with the time. But
isn't the next question more serious? Because if in fact does not diverge down so t equals zero, then there must be some other knob you can turn, other classes of systems you can explore that will let you get further and further down the temperature. Whereas if in fact there is an intrinsic, something like a phase transition.
What I'm going to however, what I'm going to try to say is that if I am, and I will go back to this a lot, but if I am in a situation, and I will give specific examples, in a situation where my time scale is 1 second, and the system in equilibrium would take a year, the kind of way the system responds is the same in 1 second as it would respond if its time scale would be, instead of a year, infinity. And however, there are general things you can say, and they are very similar. So I need not, of course I would like to know whether there is a transition or not, but you can do a lot without answering that question. And it's, in any case, it's going to be a very tough question, so better not try to answer. So in any case, what I want to say is that this moment is when the glass is born. By definition, a glass is the moment that this happens, that you fell out of equilibrium. And you see that this depends on the procedure. So there is no glass transition. This is what glass people call TG, the glass temperature. If there is an absolute transition, this happens lower, and you call it with another name. But the one you have in your life is this one. It's a moment you fell out of equilibrium. And it depends. For example, if you're, instead of with real life, you're working with a computer, this will happen before, because your times inevitably will be shorter. Okay, so what happens to these objects? Let me erase this. When I did this step and I jumped from C to this temperature, but I didn't allow the system to go to equilibrium. And this comes to Anette's question. Well, if I could be able to go up to equilibrium, I would have another curve which would be something like this, and another curve which would be something like this. But what happened is I'm not giving the system the time to do it, to change, really. So in fact, it turns out, and this it could not, it's not it's not perhaps a necessity, but it turns out that what happens is that as time passes, from the moment I made this rather quick jump, very slowly, now the waiting time at which I is measured from the moment I did this last jump. So it's from the moment I fell out of equilibrium. And from the moment I fell out of equilibrium in terms of the waiting time, this alpha relaxation time very slowly starts to adapt to this new value. So the system is as if it would be working its way, and the same will happen here. Working its way up here very slowly. And it's getting, it's alpha time, it's getting progressively adapting and getting slower and slower, adapting to get to this point. And this is what is called aging. The system is trying to get to this situation in which it's much more viscous, but it's slowly adapting its viscosity to get to that point. So now the question as to whether there is a transition or not is the question whether the aging will last forever, or you will get to a point at which, okay, you're in equilibrium again. It would, but not so much, but you're out, provided of course you don't raise it again, but you're fatally out of equilibrium. It's very difficult to. This process is called aging, and all these violet curves are labeled by the waiting time measured from the moment I did this quick jump, and these curves will move, viscosity will go up, and okay, all this will happen at the same time. And what is happening while the system ages is that while cage motion doesn't do much, structural motion gets progressively harder and harder. Progressively, not with change of temperature, but with time now. So imagine a crowd of civilized people that don't touch one another, but where people can move, but it's getting compactified because all these people want to go near the rock star. And to move within the crowd is getting progressively harder and harder. Okay, so this is what a glass does. Now, the same can be said of granular matter. Imagine you have granular matter and you tap it, or you vibrate it very slowly, and it gets like coffee, ground coffee, it compactifies. you have more or less the same situation. Your cage motion is due to the vibration you're applying. There is a restructuration, which is what makes the coffee go down in the tin. And this structural motion, you can imagine that, gets slower and slower as the coffee gets more and more compactified. So you still have this same kind of phenomenology, except that the cage motion is not a thermal agitation. It's the agitation I'm doing when I'm... Oh, yes? In the? There is no temperature, because the energy is something I'm putting in a non-thermal manner, so there is no temperature.
So where are they going on the curve while they're changing?
Yeah, this will not be temperature, this axis. It's going to be intensity of shaking, let's say.
Okay, but it still has temperature.
You could have something very similar to that, yes. Some noise, but not a thermal, a well-defined, nice bath. Okay, so question again. Let me insist again. The question whether this time has become infinity or not is intimately related to the question how long will aging last before it stops. Now, if aging lasts for example, in plastics, we know that at least 30 years is this time. We still don't know whether it's infinity or not. But 30 years, you don't see any sign of this process stopping. And what is the experiment with plastics? These are very beautiful experiments of late 70s or things like that. You get your plastic and you wait, you do this, all this very quickly, whoops, and you arrive here. And now you try to compress it. And the plastic responds quickly at the beginning. This is like sound waves. And then very slowly it creeps to a new length. And because the system is aging, if you repeat this experiment later on, considering from the moment you quenched it, it does the same, but then it creeps slower. And I don't have the graphs here, but they're very beautiful experiments where this speed at which the creep happens changes. After a minute, it does it in a minute. After a month, it takes a month to do it. And after a year, and in fact the experiments go up to at least 4 years, after 4 years this creep takes of the order of 4 years. So this creep motion scales more or less with the age of the system, and this has been swiped from 1 second to 4 years at least. And these are Strauch's experiments. So given a piece of plastic, you can decide its age just by attempting to compress it. Okay, so let me say another way of doing these experiments is the following. I could do something similar. Imagine now I go very slowly through this line. Now let us assume that there is no divergence. I get to have this incredibly viscous liquid, and now I shear it slowly, or I vibrate it. You know that when a system is sheared, it tends to become less viscous. This is called shear thinning. And in fact, what happens is that now when you're shearing, you're driving your system out of equilibrium. You are, I suppose, in equilibrium, but now you shear it. And what happens is that the system rejuvenates. It behaves as if it's this length, which here was... It was the waiting time that decided this this correlation time. When you shear, where your parameter is the shear rate, the parameter that will decide it is the shear rate. So get a system that is equilibrated at this temperature and start shearing it, and it will behave as if it were younger and younger and younger and younger. And it will keep, if you keep it shearing, it will keep at this age. So it will stay being at exactly that same age. So that's the other element. And you can always play with both. So just to go back to the example of domain growth. Imagine you have oil and vinegar, which are droplets that are coalescing and are getting larger and larger. Aging for that system is just making your droplets bigger. And so that as time passes, these droplets just coalesce and you have bigger and bigger. When you shear them or you stir them, this is a typical way to make the droplets smaller. So rejuvenation is just activating things so that you break whatever order there was, and you get a system that is behaving as if it were younger. Okay? So now let me say the ideas of the before the war. Mr. Toole, even before the 40s, conjectured that a glass which was taken out of equilibrium to this situation, somehow behaved as it had. Now it's an out of equilibrium system, so I have no right to even talk about temperature. But what he proposed is that it might have two temperatures. The first degrees of freedom would move. I don't know if he was as explicit as that. But there would be the bath temperature, which is TD. But what he conjectured is that the system behaved as if it had also a temperature which would be a memory of the moment it fell out of equilibrium. So somehow the system here, which is out of equilibrium, would be at the same time at the bath temperature, I have to say what I mean by at the same time, and having hangovers from the temperature it had when it fell out of equilibrium. So this this is a phenomenological idea that was, people used it as a parameter. It wasn't very clear. It never died. It never was accepted completely. It has a long story, long history. So let me show you what was suggested by the theory, what you can try to do. Oops. Sorry, not breaking. Sorry. So let me try to say, how can I measure a temperature to start with? So let me try to reproduce Toole's idea, but in a sort of, with a Gedanken experiment. So I have my liquid in this thing, which now has fallen out of equilibrium, or not, depending. And in order to measure the temperature, what I do is I want to connect this, suppose we are in equilibrium, I want to connect this piston to some sort of system that will be my thermometer, and through, for example, the easiest would be a spring and a mass, so that this has frequency omega. If I'm in equilibrium, I'm guaranteed by equipartition that a half kT has to be the typical energy of the oscillator. So how do you measure a temperature? You connect this spring and mass system. You measure on average where does it get the energy? It gets it from the vibrations. And where does it lose it? It loses it in the viscosity of the liquid. So on average, what happens, and this is one of the proofs of equipartition, on average, there's energy going here given by noise, which is the correlation, measured by the correlation, and there's energy going back given by the dissipation, which is given by the measured by the response. And this balance is exactly so that in equilibrium this energy exactly gives you half kT. This is equipartition, there's no surprise, and you can use this just by looking at the average energy of this to deduce the energy of the liquid.
Are you driving the system by moving mass, or is
the mass vibrates because there is noise?
So there is heat flowing into the gas.
There is heat from this liquid going into the spring because it makes vibrate the, and it's also lost on it because the liquid is viscous, and the precise balance of these two factors is guaranteed by the fluctuation dissipation theorem precisely, and this is what guarantees equipartition. It's a nice calculation, a nice exercise to do. So this is why these two things have to be related, because otherwise there would be no equipartition. Now, we can now say, well, but now we can play with omega. So if people in the old times were right, I could try to measure high frequencies. I construct a spring mass system with high frequencies or with low frequencies, and I would be able to pinpoint if there are two temperatures or not. And in fact, so what does this tell me? It tells me that I have to try to see what the relation between fluctuations and dissipation, correlation and response, are going to be, because this is what plays in the balance. So what I'm going to do, this suggests, is that I, with no justification other than this one, for the out of equilibrium system, let me try to plot correlations versus response. So originally it gives a straight line, which is minus 1 over t, and it's this balance that makes equipartition work. This is just equilibrium. Now what happens if I go to this situation where I am out of equilibrium? I can still try to plot, sorry about this, one waiting time against one waiting time, the same waiting time against the same waiting time. Nobody forbids me from making a parametric plot here, only that I don't know the result because I'm not in equilibrium. If I am, I know I get this. But while the system is aging, or while the system is kept young by shearing, I can try to do it. And in fact, surprise, surprise, and this comes from the solution of this kind of models, what you get is, for the values of correlation corresponding to this first part, which are the fast things, you get something that resembles very much equilibrium with minus 1 over t bar. No surprise there. It says, as somebody mentioned, I don't know who, that the fast cage motion is as if it would be in equilibrium at temperature of the bath. So in this case, it would simply be Td, the true temperature of the bath. But surprise, surprise, when you solve the problem, what you find is that for this other motion, the violet motion, you get something like this. You get a straight line, at least in the analytically solvable models, which defines another temperature, because if I connect now to a spring system which corresponds to the frequency given by this kind of violet time scales, I will measure, using this thermometer, in fact, Tf. So you see, this was not historically at all the motivation, but a posteriori one could say, to resurrect Toole's idea, knowing that a thermometer has to measure temperatures, if I want to try to measure two of them, I can play with the frequency. I know that what decides this balance is the fluctuation dissipation theorem, so let me try this plot, and surprise, surprise, you get two temperatures. And this has a precise definition. It says that whatever is associated, response and noise, with fast motion behaves as if it were in equilibrium, and whatever is associated with slow motion behaves as if it were in a temperature which is comes out from the model, which is of the order, but not exactly equal to, as Toole had guessed, of the temperature where you fell out of equilibrium.
Sorry for being pedantic, but when you are in the equilibrium regime, the pink curve,
yes,
you plot the time-dependent susceptibility versus the time-dependent correlation?
Yes, yes.
And the same then for the...
Yes, so there are two, this is a parametric plot with two times, T and TW, and all the lines, surprisingly, fall on to only a single line. In principle, they have no need because there are two parameters. But surprisingly enough, they fall into two straight lines at long times. And these straight lines are these two. So this will happen. And let me show you this. Okay, this is the kind of thing that comes out from this kind of mean field models, but let me show you what a simulation gives. And I think that this is a simulation with a Leonard Jones system, which is realistic. This is very easy, relatively easy to simulate. So this is the kind of thing you get. This is with no assumption, just a simulation of a Leonard Jones system. So you see that it looks quite well. Of course, there's no proof here, but it quite looks like this. You can prove, you can see that it's the bath temperature. You can see it with the simulation. But this looks very much like another straight line. So it means that these mean field models are not entirely telling you things that are not true. And these data are from Ludovic Berthier and Jean-Louis Barra, by the way. This is for a liquid that is being sheared. It's in equilibrium, and now you start shearing. This is a very viscous liquid, and the liquid shear thins. It corresponds to one of the pictures where it was the shear rate that played a role. The bath temperature is not changing, you're just shearing. And as you shear it, its temperature, you see its straight line becomes flatter, signaling the fact that this is getting an effective temperature which becomes higher and higher. This is for a glass that is aging at two different times. And finally, one of the predictions of the mean field thing, which is a fortunate one, is that all effective temperatures associated with all correlations, a bit coming back to Boris's question, should be the same. And in fact, these people did for many correlations considering different distances, time correlations, but with different k vectors. And you see that the effective temperatures are parallel. These curves are parallel. And this one is a bath temperature. And this tells you that the temperatures you define in this way are the same whatever mode k you're coupling to. This was, again, this is something you can prove in the mean field models, but you do not know in real life. But it's a good news. It's good news because then you know that you can measure coupling to whatever you want. And at a given time, you have this temperature. So just I want to. So just this to show you that. So now a connection with quantum systems. This is and granular matter. Suppose you have a quantum glass. So this is work by Leticia with Gustavo Lozano. What they did is they tried to they solved a quantum system that was aging. So this is a system of some sort of mean field model like the one I showed, but the particles are now quantum. And now there is a problem because in a quantum system, if I want to do such a plot at high temperatures, you know the fluctuation dissipation theorem in quantum mechanics is not as simple as in classical mechanics. It doesn't give you a straight line. This is the proof of the fluctuation. It gives some sort of thing. So even at high temperatures, a quantum system satisfies the fluctuation dissipation theorem, but you're not going to see it as a straight line here. This is at high temperatures in equilibrium. When they solved at low temperatures for an aging system, what they found is that you still get this for the fast motion, but again, surprise, for the slow rearrangements, you got a temperature which looked exactly like a classical system at that temperature. So in other words, the kind of fluctuation dissipation theorem you have for the slow motion, the structural degrees of freedom, is classical. So this is for quantum systems. And this is, again, another surprise, because who would, well, a posteriori you could say, well, slow rearrangements are not particularly quantum in nature, so this could be some sort of explanation. But this comes out from a calculation. And a similar result, which I did, inspired in this one, is the following. Imagine you have a granular matter. So you asked me, there is no thermal bath in granular matter. So if I'm in the, say, high energy phase, and I'm really shaking the granular matter, what I will get, of course, if I do such an experiment, is nothing. It's something. There's no reason why there should be fluctuation dissipation theorem. So again, you get nothing. Now try the low energy, the very compact phase. This is again based on a mean field version. And the fast motion, which is the cage motion, again doesn't have anything specific. It's non-thermal. But again, surprise, surprise, the restructurations, the structural changes, again behave very much as if they had a temperature. This is a much more surprising situation because there's no reason why there should be temperatures at all in this game. Yes.
These systems you've been talking about typically have one type of excitation. Now, suppose I had a system with two types of excitation,
like
with electronic and spin degrees of freedom, something like that.
They should give you the same.
Okay. What I guess I'm wondering, I guess you're about to answer my question, but just to say, is it obvious that the slow degrees of freedom in both types of excitation should actually have the same?
Well, in the mean field case, this is what happened. It is a big surprise. You put two glasses in contact with different effective temperatures, which would have different effective temperatures separately, but when evolving together, they somehow rearrange to get the same effective temperature for the slow degrees of freedom, which is, when you think of it, quite a big surprise, because it means that the system is unable to make its slow and its fast degrees of freedom communicate, but it is able to make its slow degrees of freedom communicate with the slow degrees of freedom of another system, as if each time scale would have it would be very able to communicate with the same time scales of whatever, even if they're very weak, but not with even the faster or slower time scale in the same system, which is a bit of a surprise. But again, this you can prove in solvable model.
Have they looked at numerically for different
data? Yeah, well, this is the picture I was showing. I show it to you here. Like this. This is what they did. They tried different wave vectors in a glass, and this is a simulation, and all these lines are parallel. With these two glasses, the thing that has been done is Leticia and I tried with two spin glasses which artificially recoupled, and it works.
But those were two mean fields.
When it's mean field, it works exactly.
Okay.
And when it's not mean field, it seems to work to the extent that you can say anything numerically.
But that's quite surprising.
Yeah. So it says that, well, the temperatures, and, well, so now I think I should conclude, but let me say two things and as an advertisement. The fact that, why did I insist on the granular stuff? Because the granular stuff, this temperature appeared, and once you have a temperature, you can wonder, is there an underlying statistical mechanics? It has to be a bizarre one, because it has to give you two temperatures and not one. In the case of granular, it has to give you one when there is no underlying temperature in the bath, which is even stranger. It turns out that this idea is closely related to Edwards's construction. So if you take seriously Edwards' construction, for the people who have heard about it, this would be some sort of statistical mechanics of this slow temperature. So I think it's better that I do not continue, but just to mention that not only we recover the ideas of Toole, but you also recover the ideas of Sam Edwards, and realize that they're closely related to those of Toole, and now you have at least a limit where everything works exactly. So that limit is the mean field limit. Whether that mean field limit is pathological for certain things or not, of course, remains to be seen. But at least you guess a lot of things thanks to this limit, and it's a limit where you can solve everything, and these things are rigorously true and well-defined. So I better stop here. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed. Questions, comments, remarks?
So, you're talking about two temperatures. I mean, I guess this is a little bit of a race between maybe her question. Why, I mean, two temperatures mean two timescales. Why exactly two timescales?
No.
Is that
maybe
the definition of a class?
No, sorry, not two. There are two separate questions. Whether there are only two timescales or more, in fact, in spin glasses, the situation is that you have a hierarchy of timescales, not only two. You happen to have two in this kind of model, and it's a solution that comes out from the model that there are only two. That's half of the question. The other answer is, given that you have a certain number of timescales, why at each timescale should there be only one temperature for all observables? At the mean field level, this is the case. And fortunately, because if different observables would have different temperatures, then this temperature is not very well defined. So at the mean field level, this is rigorously true. Whether it's true or not in real life, it's a numerical, mostly numerical evidence, and it doesn't seem to be working so badly. Yes, actually it's in the time domain, but sure. But I could have, for example, this could be a liquid that also is magnetized. So I could have done as the actual experiment of Israelov and Grijera was done. I could do this. If in addition, the liquid is magnetic. And who tells me that at the same frequency, this is going to give me the same temperature? In the mean field models, it does. In real life, it's a nice experiment to do and hard one to, yeah, very hard, because noise measurement is hard.
Do you see in mean field theory why it does?
So I'll say two words about Edwards, and it's not going to answer why it does, but it's going to say what you have to prove, at least. What happens is that in this kind of system, let's say, I'm going to be a bit not very precise, but I see that I have a lot of metastable states, and the log of the number of these metastable states grows like this. So there are a lot of them. So when the dynamics gets to this point, it is exploring certain number of metastable states. Yes, yes, energy. So your dynamics is sort of compactifying, going down. And actually, if you measure the, if you were in equilibrium, there would be a temperature which would be the derivative of the entropy of the number of states with respect to the energy. This is what Edwards said. You have to assume that you are exploring all the metastable states with a flat measure. In fact, it turns out for the mean field system that this is exactly equal to the temperature coming from the dynamics. You can show it. So what you have to prove now is that, in fact, your system is visiting these flat regions with a flat, these relatively trapped regions with a flat measure. And this you cannot prove. I mean, you don't have any Liouville theorem, so you have to see how you can argue that.
The motion among the alternative states is a structural motion.
It's a structural motion.
Inside,
it's just at the usual temperature. So what you have to prove is that, and that is far from being proven, whether it is or not an approximation. In mean field, it is exact, but even in mean field, you don't understand why it happens. You see, you check that this is true, but even there, you don't see exactly why it should be flat, but it is. So this is the connection between an approach a la Edwards and this kind of thing. And this is, for me, the most interesting question now, because you have to see how you have this pseudo-ergodicity going on.
Model
the high-dimensional sphere? It could be.
I think this would be interesting for the group to get to know in more detail.
It's a very nasty model to solve. This is why I said it isn't the best, but it's the best to exemplify the fact that it is some sort of mean field version of particles. But yes.
What other models?
Well, of course, you have the models with disorder, like B-spin-like and things like that. But those are always debatable because you introduce disorder and people have to believe that this has something to do with the structure of glass. The other one sounds more palatable, but from the analytic point of view, it's some sort of matrix model. What's the name of the matrix model? Penner. But replicated or dynamical version, which is quite horrible, but it gives some kind of result.
One more question before we wrap things up. When I think of an ordinary crystal of copper, I think of caged motion.
True.
But I also have vacancy diffusion.
Yes.
So is there any extent with the circle like in
the Yeah, what I think that happens in a crystal with a vacancy that can move is that if you can couple, and you can, to the vacancy will be diffusing, but it will be thermalized with the bath. While here, no. And that's, I think, even vacancies can be in equilibrium. Let me make an analogy. If you have domain growth, the walls of the domains are responsible, in the case of domain growth, for a regime like this one, and they are out of equilibrium. But if you have a system that has domains in equilibrium, then the walls are perfectly well thermalized. So I think that vacancies in a crystal are going to respond just like, because the system is in equilibrium. Defects, no, because defects want to die. So they are going in the dying direction. So they are compactifying, and they are certainly not in equilibrium. I mean, line defects, which are entangled, and so on.
Further questions or comments? Let's thank Jorge one more time.